while they are. That I'm now delivering the ultimate truth. It's much too amazing and mysterious. So I spent many years ago, I spent some time in India, in McLeodganj, is the residence of the Dalai Lama. And when he is around, he gives these short audiences, or not short, he gives audiences where you basically get blessed by him, which is really sweet. And someone asked him then, what is the particular aspect of Buddhist understanding? This is somehow this is in my memory, because it wasn't actually really that people could ask questions, but maybe just someone dared to do. And he answered in one sentence. It's the understanding of interdependence. And I loved this. What it evoked in me was, oh, really, I loved this idea. And one of my first responses was also rather ignorant and arrogant, was, yeah, and it's quite obvious, isn't it? You know, things are interdependent. And yes, they might be, and also just to point out, actually, this teaching of interdependence, of co-arising, is actually a very, very profound, deep teaching. And I can assure you, after 20 years of meditating, I'm scratching the surface. Yeah, so just to put this in a context. And I'm just sailing a little bit along with it, but just to mention this, that it's quite a profound and a really deeply, I think what is also really put, a deeply liberating teaching. So there was this immediate response in my being, and then actually there is a question which is really, really, really alive for me right now in terms of teachings in general, but in particular with this teaching. Does it actually inform my life, or is it just a nice concept? You know, my first teacher, you know, he said, our understanding, whatever we are seeing on the cushion, whatever we are seeing on retreat, our understanding, like the test for it, is that it has to express itself in our life. You know? So I think it can be quite a good question, not out of a should, but actually really, yeah, quite open, interested question to really ask them how much are these teachings just ideas I take on? And make sense of them on a cognitive level, you know, I get it somehow. And how much is it actually embodied, or how much is it a lived experience? And I have to say for myself, sometimes it's more a lived experience, and sometimes not. Sometimes it's just a concept. But I think we have to really ask ourselves, when we engage in this practice, this important question, does it actually express itself in how I see myself, how I live my life? And again, not as a should. Because this is also how they can actually really transform and liberate. So there is this very particular understanding of Buddhist teachings, and after centuries of the perspective of separation, you know, especially since Descartes, it's also that science discovers in recent years, you know, in physics and evolutionary theory, system theory, it makes findings which actually point to a very similar understanding. And I will say very little about it. So for example, an American physicist, Mr. Stapp, I think he is known for his work on quantum physics, you know, just a quote which I find is beautiful, is that an elementary particle is not an independently existing, analyzable entity. This is how I learned it in school, as far as I went in science. Atom, this is the last undivisible unit. That it's not. It is, in essence, a set of relationships that reach outward to other things. It's beautiful. I think it's really much more exciting than an atom. It's a set of relationships that reach outward to other things. Also, according to Darwinism, evolution was in, again, this is something how I learned it in school, as far as I went with it. You know, that evolution is a product of fierce competition, you know, with each species fighting against the other. You know, in the battle to survive, survival of the fittest. And now, again, a quite different perspective is coming up. So what is now accepted in mainstream science is so-called endosymbiotic theory. And this says that important steps in our evolution have occurred through cooperation between species. They have occurred through a cooperation between species, even to the point where separate organisms joined together to create entirely new life forms. So a quote from one of the scientists said, life did not take over the globe by combat, but by networking. Again, it's a different perspective. You know, one could say here, what I call Kirsten sitting here, it's actually a networking of microorganisms. On one level, this is the truth, you know. I think we have a lot of friendly bacteria in our guts. Sometimes the unfriendly, another one, those ones take over. But it's quite amazing. A friend of mine, he is quite ill at the moment, and I learn a lot about digestion. It's absolutely amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Did you know? I just have to get this. I'm just amazing when I heard it. Apparently, and I'm not a doctor, apparently the cells in our guts and our renew every 4 to 7 days. They renew. And the old ones communicate with the new ones. So if something really changed, they would say, hey, listen, now this is happening. Get used to it. You know, I mean, this is, of course, I'm making a little bit fun, but this is amazing, you know, what intelligence is operating here, you know, in our guts, you know, and this is only one small perspective. So in recent decades, also a new development in psychology, so it's called eco-psychology, has developed. And one of its most ambitious endeavors is really that it seeks to redefine sanity, mental health, within a much bigger context. One could say within an environmental context, which could be everything environment. Doesn't have to be just nature as we, you know, environment as we traditionally may understand it. So eco-psychology says that seeking to heal the being, the soul in their language, without reference to the environmental systems of which we are integral part of, is a form of self-destructive blindness. So Lester Brown says, he's one of the leaders in eco-psychology, that in simple terms, we cannot restore our own health, our sense of well-being, unless we restore the health of everything, of our environment. Makes sense, doesn't it? James Hillman passed away some years ago. Very, very amazing, actually, thinker, iconoclastic thinker, Jungian therapist. He says, The human subject has all along been implicated in the wilder world of nature. How could it be otherwise? Since the human subject is composed of the same nature as the world, how could it be otherwise? Psychology, so dedicated to awaken human consciousness, needs to wake itself up to one of the most ancient human truths. We cannot be studied or cured apart from the planet. And again, it's an interesting, and it's a very new way actually of even seeing and perceiving psychology, which can be so much about the self. And then it's so hard to even define where does the self end, where does it begin. So it's like all this is like really in areas really, and I love it, you know, just to read about it, it's literally thrown into the air, you know, like God, we have to look at this differently. So there are the teachings, and then there is this scientific understanding on interdependence on one side, we could say. And I'm simplifying here, and I have to simplify in talks of 45 minutes. So we could say this is on one side, and on the other side we could also say that we are immersed in a very, very different message. Yeah, and this is what I call, it's actually, and others call, it's a story of separation. It's a story of separation. And over the last year, I gave a couple of talks about this story of separation, which is actually seen by some thinkers at this time as one of the prevailing stories of our time. And so without wishing to repeat a lot of what has been said and recorded, just want to say a little bit about it. Some time ago, last year, I also read a book which was about the development of Western philosophy, which was called The Passion of the Western Mind. And what was very, very obvious in this, and absolutely fascinating to see the development of how we perceive ourselves and our relationship to us and the world. And one could say that certain times have certain prevalent stories. Stories, perspectives, worldviews. Different frames of reference. Different conceptions of reality. Different ways of perceiving the world, as I said before. Perceiving us, perceiving the relationship between us and this world, and it's absolutely fascinating. I was really felt like, wow, you know, wow. So the accepted perceptions, this is what fascinates me, the accepted perception, worldview, story, whatever we call it, philosophy of an area, of an era, not of an area, of an era, of a time, defines everything. It defines what is important, it defines roles, and it even defines what is real, what we perceive as real. And I think what is my point I'm making here is not to underestimate this, because sometimes we think, oh, it's just philosophy, but there is an expression of certain worldviews. And, as some say, one of the stories we are having now is the story of separation. And Charles Eisenstein, some of you might know him, he's a thinker and activist, he said that separation is woven into every aspect of our civilization, and it can take so many forms. You know, it started with mind and matter. Separation of mind of matter. And it's expressed in splits of either good, either or, and actually the split of either or. either good, bad, perfect, imperfect. Human nature split. This split didn't make sense 1,000 years ago, and I don't want to make, oh, this was wonderful, it's just what I really got. It didn't make sense, this split. Was that not? What are you speaking about? The division of reality into material and spiritual realms, the division of body and mind, of humans here, nature there. You know what I said already. And I think this story, this, if we call it a story, world, your way of perception, way of perceiving, I think not to underestimate that we are really, really immersed in it. It's what we are most exposed to. You know, and it invites a certain way of being in the world. And again, I simplify something here, but I also want to make a point. You know, it invites the need of competition. Divides people into winner and loser. You know, survival of the fittest, and with it often comes in the conviction that we have to do it on our own. Who thinks they have to do it on their own? Oh, I have to do it on my own. Yeah. And I think this doing on our own, I mean, it's a perception I know well.
Yes.
You know it. Andrea also knows it, but I have to do it on my own. You know, it's maybe an expression of another aspect of this worldview, which is the cultural ideal. This is something also I got from a reading about eco-psychology. It's of the heroic autonomy. The ideal of heroic autonomy. And the image that comes up with me quite naturally for me, it's like the cowboy who is riding alone into the sunset. You know, it's like with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. You know, I'm a lonesome cowboy. Yeah. And in this, you know, I'm making fun of it, but also seeing how it's maybe operating in us. You know, in this heroic ideal, actually, separation is seen as the route to respect strength and status. You know, it comes with a whole way of perceiving ourselves. And it, as an ideal, it has to deny and dismiss dependence. It has to deny and minimize inner dependence. It doesn't fit the ideal. And we might say, oh no, I'm not believing in this heroic ideal, but maybe, I'm just contemplating this, one of the less extreme manifestations of this heroic ideal is what I encounter a lot, is our difficulties. We very often have to ask for help. You know, to request some support, to be on the receiving end. And it's something I hear so often. You know, I just taught again, like the Buddha Dharma Sangha camp on the edge of Dartmoor, and it's a community of about 140 people living for a week together, and this is a subject coming up again and again. It's so hard for me to ask for help. Or I speak with someone and I say, have you asked for help? And there is this light bulb moment. It's like it never even occurred to them. Oh, yeah. It's so interesting. And then also seeing how hard it can be to receive it. Much easier to give. And also knowing, dependent arising, the receiver can only arise, or the provider The one who gives out can only arise if there is someone there to receive. So if you want to be a helper, you need someone to be helped. It's a co-arising, just as a slight side remark. And of course, this radical or heroic autonomy as a cultural idea does not support easily other forms of growth and being in this world. It's not what it is celebrating, cherishing, respecting, especially those which are based on relationship and connection. Because according to this idea, again I'm making the same point, is the facts of interdependence and dependence of our being alive can be actually been seen and perceived as a failure, a humiliation, no, rather than a natural and absolutely inevitable and beautiful part of being alive. Like, oh God, I'm so dependent. Horrible, I'm so dependent. Oh God, God, I'm so dependent. Wow. Wow. And maybe we can be really a little bit creative here, you know, rediscovering, how can we rediscover again our profound interdependence, this wisdom of interdependence. You know, to really acknowledge that we impact and we are impacted. You know, and I reframed the truth of interdependent as belonging, and I'm aware that it can be a loaded word, but we are part of. And this doesn't mean, and this is very important, that we need to merge, you know, or lose our individuality, not at all. We all have our very unique and particular expressions and gifts. You know, we are all part of something which is so multi-layered, multicolored. You know, sometimes I call it a mandala, you know, we are all part of a mandala. You know, sometimes we have particular colors and shapes in it, but we always are part of it. So we need to develop as individuals, of course. You know, we have to find the beauty of our unique expression, yet absolute separation is a illusion. So we can and we need to act from our own center, but it's impossible not to interact with, be impacted by, or depend on others, on human beings, on the natural environment. You know, our surroundings by everything. The air we breathe, the patterns of the season, the texture of the light outside, whatever it might be. You know, we are impacted, it impacts us. We are interwoven, we are part of. And another eco-psychologist, I think she's an a feminist take on this, who looks at the female, feminine and masculine separations there. And she says, you know, she uses the term set of the separate self, she uses the term separative self. Do I pronounce this right? Separative self. To highlight that we may attempt to separate, but this is an attempt that can never succeed. And if we try to separate fully, more and more fully, or if we try to engage in this endeavor which is doomed to fail, what happens is that we have to armor ourselves more and more against our inner depths, I think, and also against the outer world. Correct. Doing it on my own. And of course, to some extent, some degree of perception of separateness is absolutely wired into our makeup. You know, like in every moment, in every instant, we're like in fight and flight response. You know, there is a danger or a perceived danger. There is a very, very clear sense of me and other. You know, it's a very clear sense. It's either I'm getting out of here or I'm fighting, or, you know, it's not about, you know, but I'm not separate. So there's nothing wrong with this. There's nothing wrong with this. It's part of our makeup. So it's part of our reality. And again, we have to hold different aspects here. And another part, so that actually at times of chaos we feel, we will perceive ourselves separate. And another part of our reality is also that our very existence is relational. It's relational on all levels. Many of you maybe read the book, I think she is from Oxford, by Sue Gerhardt, Why Love Matters. Anyone read it? Yeah, some of you. It's a wonderful book, isn't it? I think it's a wonderful book. And she speaks a lot about brain development, you know, how the brain develops and actually then how it impacts on the infant and the grown-ups. And she speaks of the social brain that can and will only develop after birth. So, you know, when we come to this world, our brain is very, very undeveloped. And what it needs to develop is contact. It's relationship, sounds, sights, input. You know, it develops through interaction, through connection. It is how the brain grows. I think, again, it's fascinating. You know, it develops through relating. So our existence is relational. Also something Shantideva discovered and Nagarjuna discovered and Thich Nhat Hanh expresses. And then there's also the truth of how our experience can be so different when we are stressed in any way. Maybe you can just sense, you know, just can you remember like a stressed state? just bring it up. A stressed state, you know, can be very small, can be tiredness. Tiredness is a stress. You know, pressure of any kind. Exhaustion, fear, worry. Yeah. So if you just sense into it, do you think it's fair to say that the more we are stressed deep down, the more there will be a sense of separateness? Yeah? It's interesting. So the more fear there is, the more worry, the more stress of the so-called outside, the more everything can be seen as separate, alien, threatening. And again, I'm not saying this is wrong. I just say this to understand what is happening. It's not, it shouldn't happen. This is what happens. There is this door song. I think it's great, which really expresses it. People are ugly when you're alone, you know, when you're strange. I can't sing now. I don't want to sing it now. I'm not a good singer, but I really, you know, it really expresses it. You know, everything becomes a little bit, actually, quite hostile. We could also say that any moment of aversion, again, I just really want to play a little bit around, any moment of aversion, of not liking, of wanting things to be different, of hankering after something, any moment of this actually again can be seen as a moment of separation, because we are distancing us from the truth of the moment. Don't like, don't want. So another way of how we feel more separate. The more we believe that we are not good enough, that we are lacking, that we should try harder, or should try less, or whatever, the more there is a sense of separateness. When fear is operating, low self-esteem, anxiety, and. What happens is that we are contracting. That's what is happening. Yeah. And what also happens with it is that the more we contract, and again, really on this level, you know, and of course there is more, but we can actually to some extent simplify it to a level of contraction. The more the world becomes the other, and also in our inner life, the more parts of ourselves we can't accept, we dislike, we hate, we want to get rid of, become the other, the enemy. So when these stresses are around you, stress, fear, anxiety, whenever they are operating, you know, there is this acceleration of thoughts, and then we get pulled into a certain vortex of compelling thoughts. And with it, a whole world arises. Our view narrows, we fixate, we lose spaciousness, we lose the wider perspective and malleability of our mind. Again, not to make it wrong. But just to make my point here, when you're really angry with someone, what happens when you're really angry? You know, I'm pretending now I'm angry with you, James, I'm not. Just as a, you know, something happened, I'm angry with James, I'm completely narrowing him down. You did this, yeah? I completely lose the wider aspect of all the other qualities of James. You know, and I perceive myself also, my perception shrinks down, and I have been wronged by you. It's very easy. But you see that's what I'm speaking about. You know, and then we believe in this world. We believe in it. And again, not to make it wrong, but to see, you know, when we really believe in this narrow fixated view, when we take it as the truth, how easily we create the bad other. Or, you know, could be also the good other and I'm the bad one. Yeah. And often in how easily with this comes up with a certain storyline which actually supports and strengthens this sense of separateness. And sometimes all we can do, you know, the wise, the skillful response, even when you're in the midst of it, I'm here really, really angry with James because whatever he did to me, or I perceive he did to me, is to open up to the possibility that we are just now in the wave of a certain way of perceiving, in a certain constricted way of perceiving, in the pull of a very, right now, very convincing story. It's not the truth. And we don't have to make ourselves wrong that we believe it. Just to know this. Now I'm believing this, and probably it's not a good idea now to have a conversation with James. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So we sometimes all we can do is to allow, okay, we have to ride the wave right now. And as soon as there is a little bit space, you know, again, another skillful response is there something, can I bring an attitude in again, with a lot of kindness, can I find a key to, so to say, that softens and melts to some degree this perception? Not, you shouldn't feel like this, it's just another harshness, but how can I melt this perception, this suffering really? And what are ways of softening a perception? Anyone an idea? What are ways of softening a perception? You know. I know you know. Anyone?
Being compassionate towards myself.
Compassion. Kindness. Absolutely. Yeah, this the quality in itself, you know, it can be to you what you say, absolutely, but all these qualities, generosity, kindness, compassion, they have softening qualities, they are relational qualities. And it doesn't mean I have to feel like this is okay. Can I step a little bit more into this to soften the sense of separation? Does it make sense what I'm saying? I'm not saying, and then you have to become kind. Doesn't work. You know, like how can I hold this in a way which actually does exactly this? Ah.
You include laughter.
Humor, absolutely. Humor, absolutely. Yeah, very good. Yeah, humor. Yeah.
I always say to myself, I don't know what's going on in people's lives. There may be other reasons.
Exactly. Great key can sometimes really be helpful. I don't know. Oh, I don't know. Again, you know, the movement of my body is like, oh, I don't know. Great key. Yeah, absolutely. So sometimes all we can do is this intention of opening up to the possibility that we can hold an experience. Not when we are in the middle of it, when we are really triggered, but after there is a little bit of space that we can actually open it, see if we can open it up to receive it with some care, some kindness, some compassion. And this is one of the precious human qualities we have. We can choose this. We can choose this. You know, here we go like... And then like some minutes later, do you know this? You're really like, oh, I could. And then some minutes later, you have a little bit of more space and you can really see it differently. And we can actually really, really cultivate this. We can train, we can cultivate our mind and our heart, you know, these beautiful qualities of mind and heart. Because they are liberating, not because we should. They open up. So one could say meditation, one way of seeing meditation is about the willingness to open up, to learn to open up more and more fully to what is actually going on internally, you know, to be really present to the truth of our truth right now, right now, right now. And it will change, it will change, it will change. So this is willingness to show up to our truth. And we can see it then also as a way to actually heal the internal and outer separation. So it can be, I think it can be quite a beautiful way to even sit down. You know, it's like it's a healing session. One way of seeing it among others. So each moment of aversion, each moment of clinging, each moment of separation, so to say, there is this invitation to know intimately what is happening, to accept it, which is that's now the difficult bit, it's a very difficult bit, to accept this with tenderness. And care and grace. Because we know more and more, this is not what we are, this is not who we are, we don't have to make an identity out of it. This is only how life is expressing itself right here, right now. making this movement, and it changes, and it changes. We can get closer and no need to become it. And what we also see in our practice, that we can choose what we want to cultivate. Yesterday I spoke with a retreatant in Gaia House, and she reminded me of this story. I don't know from whom it comes originally. I think it's from the First Nation people in Northern America. And it's a story, I think it goes something like with this woman who is very, very kind and compassionate, and she is approached by others saying, how can you be so kind and compassionate? Don't you feel sometimes really angry? And she said, yes, of course I have these two wolves in myself, but I decide which one I want to feed. Yes. So it's not denying that the other one is there, you know, but it's like, what do I want to support? And what we also discover, you know, as I said before, there are all these qualities, gratitude, kindness, humor, compassion, qualities that open, just want to repeat it, that open the heart, that soften, they actually feel good. They nourish. It's very different from you should be kind. They feel good. And we know it, that they feel good. And they are deeply relational qualities. Deeply relational qualities. So I want to come to an end. So maybe just sense for a moment, you know, again playing with these two different stories I introduced a little bit today. These different ways of perceiving the story of separation, and on the other hand, the beauty and the complexity, the wonder of interdependence. Which story gives you most joy?
Just really sensing into what kind of story gives you more joy. What story feels truer? What story actually makes your heart resonate more with? Anyone want to say?